Okay, thank you. I don't know why I brought my pen.
So, thank you so much for, can you hear me? Thank you so much for coming. It's wonderful to see so many people who are interested in what has happened here in Surrey in all these years. And the idea of this program sort of is what actually happened before 1970. Because at that time, we had the influx of people coming from all over in order to be studying Zen Buddhism and music down on the corner on Morgan Bay Road. And they literally did come from all over. I came never imagining when I lived in Hamburg, Germany, in London, England, that I would end up on the crossroads in Surrey, milking cows, doing all kinds of things on the farm, raising my kids here. Not an image of that. So, so many people came here from different lives and different professions, and they came in order to benefit from the teachings of Walter Noetic and also the beautiful, beautiful surroundings that they found themselves in. So, prior 1970, I thought it would be a really good idea to have two wonderful people, Joyce Wall and Audrey Carter, talk a little bit about what it was like here at that time, as far as their lives, their regular lives, the entertainment possibilities, what it was like during that time. After they have talked a little bit, I will be asking Charles Guilford, who came, Charles, when did you come?
76.
You came in 1976. Charles will let us know what his recollections are and what his knowledge is of the Zendo community, which he is still very much involved in, and so is his wife, Susan. And then when Charles has finished with his chat and his talk and has, hopefully there are other things that come out from everybody's listening that they will remember, we will invite Phil Ritten. To do exactly that. To tell us his recollections of working on the farm with all of the sundry friends around and all of the students and everybody in Walter and people from the Surrey community as well. On the farm, and also the beginning of the Surrey concert barn, the performance barn, and then the new Surrey Theater, and how it started in the barn with those wonderful productions of Fiddler on the Roof. Was that your first one, Bill?
That it was.
Okay, so it'll be a lovely evening, and hopefully the people will contribute their memories and also questions. So it will be coming together of the community to kind of understand everyone a little better. So enjoy. Audrey Carter and Joyce Small. Here we go, pre-1970.
Okay, should we just go back and forth?
Speak right into it.
Okay. Like this? Okay. Am I good?
Good.
Okay. I could just use my loud teacher voice. Okay. So I am Audrey Carter, and Margaret called me and asked me about coming and talking about what life was like here before 1970, and I was like, well, you know, I didn't grow up here. And so she didn't know that. My children grew up here. My grandchildren have grown up here. But when I was born, my parents lived down on the Newbury Neck Road a little bit, And they lived there until I was 7 months old. They lived with my great-grandmother. And then we moved to Bucksport. My husband and I came back here in 1972. So, you know, I really came about, I could have come with Walter, you know, but I didn't. And I wasn't very far away, not like Germany. I was from Bucksport. So I said, well, you know, I remember things because my grandparents lived here and I visited them. And I'll get my aunt to come with me. So this is my aunt, Joy. And I'm going to let her introduce herself. But if I slip up and call her Babes, it's because to me, she is Babes. And that's because she's my mother's baby sister. Okay.
I am Joy, alias Babes. And I was born in Surrey. Actually, I was born in the house where Kathy and Sharon lived. And I lived there until I was about 12. And then we moved down, the next house down in the field, and I lived there till I was 18. And I got married and lived down the Blue Hill Road. But I went to school there, and then we had to walk from where we lived in their house up to the schoolhouse. They didn't bus you then, so that was part of my life. I don't know what else. We went to the old schoolhouse, and we used to have the school programs and things up at the Grange Hall, other than having at the school. So we'd walk from the school up to the Grange Hall and do whatever we needed to, came back. Because I couldn't sing at school, because my teacher told me I could not sing. And she said, just mouth it. And my father went up to the schoolhouse and he said, I'll be damned if she can't sing, she ain't gonna mouth it either. Back to you, Abby.
Okay, well, my grandmother never said that to me, but what I did tell Margaret was I remembered mostly coming to my grandparents, and I think one of the things we looked most forward to when we were kids was coming down and going to Newbury Neck. And I think maybe that's, you know, a common experience. Doesn't matter when you came to Surrey. We'd always called it going to Newbury Neck Beach, but now it's, you know, everybody calls it the Carrying Place Beach. But we had lots of family reunions. 4th of July was usually there, especially when I was young, and we would go picnicking and swimming. So anyway, what I'm going to do for most of this is I'm going to ask Joy questions. And this is kind of typical because I go to her house pretty much every Sunday night, and we just kind of sit and talk. This is how we talk about now, but we talk about then. And a lot of times I'm going like, so what about this and what about that and what happened? So she mentioned the school. So probably...
Was the schoolhouse road, is that the one where Sheldon Bisberg's house is now? Is that the dirt road that goes down to Henry Kane Field?
Well, I'm going to let Joy answer.
Joy, where was the schoolhouse?
The school was right on the corner, going toward Muggins Bay. I'm Toddy Pond, I mean.
Oh, on this side?
Yeah. There was a schoolhouse, and my mother taught at the schoolhouse down in New Burnett on the crossroad.
Yes.
When she was, before she was ever married. Yeah. That was way back, even before my time.
So that's what I was going to say. I think there were numerous schools, because when you think about it, everybody had to walk to school, or maybe, you know, there were no cars. So... Maybe you can tell.
I think there were 8 schools altogether.
Okay, so that was like she said, before her time. In fact, I think, am I right? My grandmother graduated from the old Surrey schoolhouse,
yes,
which is, I always knew it as a firehouse. So I think it closed as a school in 1953. So I would have been quite a little girl. And I remember when we were kids and we would get as far as seeing the firehouse, we always, I see the firehouse, and we knew we were almost to my grandparents. So, that. Okay, so, well, what kind of activities did they have at the school?
They didn't have much, only baseball, and they played London Bridge and games like that, but that's about all that they did outside for.
Walked around the school.
They'd run the London Bridge and drop the handkerchief. And what else, Jane?
Well, I don't know. That's all I can remember doing.
That's about it, I think. Yeah.
So I think. When we started, I was going to say this. I know at least Jane, and I'm not sure about other people who have. I know Kathy and Sharon, who are both McGraws, grew up here in Surrey, and I think probably Jane lived here her whole life. Jenny grew up here. So there are people who grew up here and probably have more answers than I do. So, you know, we're happy to answer questions or have people add information. So one thing I remember, and I think it was Jenny and Jane that I heard this from first at a Historical Society meeting, was that the kids used to do a lot of ice skating, and they used to skate where?
Up at Stillwater, above the old schoolhouse, right, and then still, you can go up there now, there's a trail, Marie knows about it, she's been up there, and she can tell you more about that than I can, probably. But she and Johnny Curtis are doing trails and stuff up there, so that it'll be interesting. Maybe we'll skate up there again.
So
who can tell?
So, and I think the other tell us the other place you skated.
We skated out on the bay.
Can you imagine that?
It was kind of rough, but we skated out there. And there used to be a channel, and we could walk across from the New Burnett Road up to the store, across the channel. Because you had to jump the channel, but I don't think any of us ever fell in.
Okay. So the other thing that Joy mentioned earlier was about the Grange. So I think the Grange has always played a big part in the town. And I'm not sure, is there anyone here who's a Grange member?
Sharon.
Okay, Sharon. So Sharon may have things to add. Again, I don't know a lot about the Grange, except that the building that's there now is not the original. There was another building, and Joy can tell you a little bit about that.
There was a church there originally, and it burned, and the Methodist Church. And so, other than that, I don't know much about it either. So, anybody else know?
I remember growing up, when I was like a teenager before, going to the Grange Hall for the Virginia Reels and the dances. Oh my goodness. Surrey dances. Weren't they awesome? Yeah. And we, you know, with just the Virginia Reel was the one I loved.
So that was one of the things I had remembered too, is because I think I might have been, you know, like 12 or something, and I remember going with my grandmother loved to dance, and I'm sure Jane and Sharon both remember that. And in fact, when she was quite elderly and couldn't remember much, when I would go to take care of her, she loved to watch Lawrence Welk. And let me tell you, every time Lawrence Welk came on, she danced with the broom. And she was well into her 90s.
96.
Yes. So the other thing that I remember you telling me about the Grange Hall was that they did some plays there. Can you tell us some more?
They did a lot of plays. They had what we used to call cowboy shows. Who's the guy that wore the patch on his eye? Slim Clark.
Whistling Slim Clark, right?
Whistling Slim Clark. And who was the other one? There was another one that used to come, too. And they had all kinds of just local talent. My Aunt Abby used to sing and do stuff up there that tell stories and everything. So, and the Grange did have a junior Grange at one time, but I went once or twice, but I didn't go. But my sister went a lot.
Okay. I think some of you may have known Tina. She was Tina Frost. Mm-hmm. But Tina just got recognized as getting the gold cane in Surrey. She's 95 years old, mm-hmm. So she's the oldest Surrey resident. But I think she also recently was recognized as being a member of the Grange. I swear they said 85 years.
Yes. 75.
75?
No.
Okay.
85.
I think it was 85. I think she...
Well, she could have been a junior. She very well could have been, because she could have belonged to Junior Grange first.
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you, if you know Tina, I will tell you where I met Tina. I met Tina at water aerobics a couple years ago, and she's still in my water aerobics class, and she is 95. She has to be the oldest person in water aerobics there. So she's pretty amazing, Surrey citizen.
That I'm up.
Okay. Well, I have my next question. Okay, so another group that had a big role in town was the church. Can you tell us some about what went on with the church?
The church used to have suppers with the Grange at town meeting, not suppers, but dinner time. And they'd vote in the morning on the ballot thing, and then they'd have the meeting after. But in between, while they were counting the ballots to see who won, church and the Grange together would be doing a supper, a dinner, and they lunch or whatever. They called it dinner. So you can pick it. It's a noon meal.
Was John McGraw the preacher there at that time when you were younger?
Not in my time. Okay. He's even older than I am.
Ann Dorrit wrote quite a story about him and how he came into the ministry.
Yes, yeah.
So another group that I, or another event I remember when I was a little girl was that my grandmother loved to play Beano. And they had Beano games every week, I think. Mm-hmm. And they were at the firehouse, and again, that was where the old schoolhouse is, but as I said before, I always knew it as a firehouse. So I do remember, again, going with my grandmother to Beano, because they wouldn't let me play, but I could watch. And I think that was an event put on by the Women's Auxiliary. So let's see if Joy will tell us about that group.
Well, I don't know if this is anything to tell, other than the auxiliary from the fire department did the... meeting for them, the Beano and everything. So, and they always had a good crowd, and they had refreshments, and I think they also did refreshments for the dances for the firemen. And they had a lot of good cooks then too.
I think, did they have suppers?
Yeah, they had suppers sometimes. Yeah.
And am I right that early on, when there was first a fire department here, it was not paid for by the town?
I don't know about that.
I'm thinking that maybe Jane knows. It seems to me like the fire department, the reason there was a women's auxiliary was that they had to raise most of their own money. And I'm not sure, but maybe, does anybody else know? Yes.
Well, when Maine burned in 1947, that was the mark where they realized throughout the state of Maine that they needed to be more serious about firefighting, because they were using World War I equipment, and there were all those fires in that same year. And in a lot of the towns, it was, you know, pay as you go, or had volunteers and whatever equipment you could put together. But after 1947, they realized it needed to be a government thing.
Okay. So
thank you, Marjorie. We didn't know that.
Pardon?
What is Beano?
Oh, what's Beano? Well, it's like bingo.
Oh, okay.
Oh, and I don't remember much about the laws, but I think there used to be a lot of that type of gambling. I mean, it was like pretty low stakes. I don't think it cost very much to get your Beano cards, and people won prizes. And again, I don't think they won very big prizes. I don't remember, you know, like dish towels or, yeah, you know, I see you know, Kathy's shaking her head, sort of remembering it. It was a low stakes thing. Mm-hmm. But then I think a point came that the state said you can't have these kind of events. Mm-hmm. And that was when they stopped doing them locally.
And changed the name from Beano to Bingo.
You can change.
They changed the name from Beano to Bingo. But I don't know why. I don't know if anybody knows why.
Because it was illegal and they broke the law that they couldn't do that. And so people who wanted to do it changed the name of the game.
So my mother said, in some states, Bingo is illegal, but so they came up with Beano.
I think Bingo was the last one.
Yeah. So, I think we've talked about most of the groups. Let's see. Oh, you know, if you talk about Surrey and you talk about theater, Surrey was really famous back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and into the early 50s. They had a group called the Surrey Playhouse. So I know Joy, I think they went out of business, 53. I don't remember them at all. But Joy can tell you about them.
Yeah, well, I don't know why they went out of business. I guess they didn't. But then they started up again. And they used to be over by the, you know where the Surrey Playhouse Road? That's where it was, up on that road, about by the cemetery up there. And they had a tea house up there, and they had a big barn across the road that belonged to the house this side, where they stored a lot of their props and everything. And
and Henry Fonda was a stage.
Henry Fonda was there.
That's right.
Yes, he was.
Shepard Sudrick was a big star.
Mary Grace Canfield was one of the last ones there. She was a wonderful.
Her husband bought it the last time, mm-hmm. and she was very angry with him because he opened another theater in Bar Harbor at the same time, so all those people who used to come from Bar Harbor to make this popular didn't come anymore. She said, that's why we went out of business. And that's when she gave us permission to do the name with the New Surrey Theater.
Oh, thank you. So I knew other people would have things to contribute. Well, that kind of winds down what we had to say, but I wanted to add, and this is more from a personal perspective, but I returned to town just about the same time that Walter was coming here and developing his community. And maybe because of that, I'm not sure, but I just always saw everybody in that group as part of the community. And I was really thinking about it. And for example, my son Dennis's best friend was Bill Rayton's son, Joseph. Margaret Baldwin was all three of my children's art teacher, and I would say she inspired my oldest son to go on to art school. Mm-hmm. You know, Susan Guilford was their fourth and fifth grade teacher, and I can tell you that they still remember things they did with Susan, and I think that she would be right up there as their favorite teacher. So, later on, I was on the school board. I remember being on the board and hiring Paula Merzicki to work in the school. So, you know, my experience was as a teacher, and I've always been involved with the schools. But when I go to the schools, it's like everybody's part of the community. And it doesn't really matter if you were from Bucksport, or if you grew up in Surrey, or if you were from Germany, or Timbuktu, I guess, whatever. So I just wanted to add that. I think that, you know, it's really formed a stronger and wonderful community, and we're all, you know, grateful for the citizens we do have. Thank you.
Neglected to mention that Marjorie Dunford is going to finish up our evening.
What?
You are.
I don't need anything.
No, you don't need anything right now, but Marjorie is going to finish up the evening of storytelling by kind of tying everything together in a very neat package. And you know it'll be worthwhile because you've been listening to her a little bit already. So now we're going to welcome Charles Guilford up onto our stage. And he will... be serious.
And here's another Carter connection. On a hot summer day in 1985, I was framing my own house on the Morgan Bay Road. John Carter showed up with a hammer and helped me joist that second floor, and his son, Ben, came and worked on it too. And Ben has a standing offer that I'll come and pound some nails in his house when the time comes. You have to excuse me, I've been entertaining a bug for the last 2 days, so I'm a little bit like this.
Charles, could I ask you to sit in the other chair because the light will shine on you a little bit more? Would
that be an improvement, actually? Okay, I'll take that as a compliment. Wait a minute, I can't see that clock. So, when Margaret talked to me about this, she said, "Well, it's about the community, the Buddhist community on the Morgan Bay Road." And Old Surrey. Well, some of you know this story, some of you don't. But Walter first came here, Walter Nowick, as a kid at the age of 14 in 1940. He stayed with Annie Morgan at the head of Morgan's Bay. And the reason he came here was that he was at that point a student of Henriette Michelson at the Juilliard, and she came here for the summer, and she would invite her students with her, or some of her students with her, and where they lived was on the, you walk straight across the crossroad and then down to the shore in a house that we came to know when our kids were little as belonging to the Gallipos. All the roads in Surrey, now this is Old Surrey, this is 1940. I heard Bob Stevens talk from this stage a few years ago about how it was to grow up in Surrey in those days, and it had been hard times. So it goes back pretty far. When Henriette Michelson wanted to get something, she walked the dirt road to Surrey, because they were all dirt in those days. So he would walk that road twice a day. From Addie Morgan's, he'd walk over there and have his private lesson, then come back, practice in the Methodist Church, which used to be opposite the Newbury Neck Cemetery, which isn't there anymore. But he did that, then come back, and then go back again, and they'd all play together and do various things. But it was, on the one hand, serious piano, and on the other hand, it was a really unusual setting. So this is the beginning of that connection, and the roots go pretty deep then. From then, that was 1940s. 14. In 1944, he was 18, he joined the army. He was on the final mop-up of Okinawa. Not a small matter. And he saw what Japan looked like after the war. Came back here in the 50s. He came back here after the war, and in 1950, having gotten interested in Zen through Henriette Michelson, his piano teacher, he went he went to Japan to study with somebody, and he was happened to have been the first person who had gone to Japan and completed that study on their terms in Japanese, reading the kanji, and the kanji meaning the Japanese, you know, the Japanese writing and Chinese and the whole works. And he would say things about that like, yeah, well, you only have to learn 1,500 kanji to do the classical study. I think, yeah, right. What we did in English. I'm just giving you a little background of what he himself was. In 1965, his teacher died. His family bought the Morgan Farm, which goes, roughly speaking, as you're going, used to go from our house, which is 409, three quarters of a mile to the bend in the road where the barn is, Surrey Opera, it says on the barn. And he was he just came here, and he didn't want to set up as a teacher particularly. He had Japanese music students. He had voice and piano students from Japan, and they came and studied with him. But eventually, it being the time it was, by that time, the late 60s, people started to show up. Lenore Strauss showed up. She was his first student. He introduced her. She came to Japan. She was an artist, and she had an exhibition. And he had started her doing meditation, and she showed up by Gauri in Surrey, and he said, well, okay. As long as I'm going to have one student, I might as well have the whole rest of it. And so people showed up. And there was a community there when I came. Now, I'm speaking now in the late 60s. I came in 1976. So there was a period there and a whole era of what went on the farm before I arrived. Walter grew up on a potato farm in Long Island. His people were, on his father's side, Russian-Polish, on his mother's side, Polish-Russian, because it was a line. Anna Nowak, by the way, passed on in 2005 at the age of 100, and her birth certificate had been signed in Tsarist Russia. And if you ever wanted to meet Mother Russia in person, that was the person. She was really something. They're all very high energy people. There are many people up and down that road who came here are still here in some connection with Walter Nowak. By, for instance, coming and studying for a few years, but then they're here, so they stay here, studying for 10 years. He stopped teaching as a formal Zen teacher in 85, but by that time we were all here. Probably starting from our house, as you're going down the Morgan Bay Road, there's kind of a clear area up there where the Colliers live and the Beardsleys, and then the road drops down. There's a big pine tree. All of that wooded area was on the right side of the road for sure, and a good bit on the left side of the road for sure, and on the right as well was the Morgan Farm, which his family had gotten for him. And when people showed up and wanted to be his student, and he convinced him that they convinced him that they were serious about it, he'd give them an acre of land. And so there are many little houses going down, particularly again that left side of the road, that were built. And it was, you know, the leftovers of the hippie era and whatnot. People in Surrey were quite concerned some people anyway, what the hell are all those people doing up there? I mean, it was there was from away, and then there was from away from away. And Buddhism, what's that?
They call them the Buddhists.
They call the Buddhists, yeah. But I have it on good authority. That is to say, Wilbur Saunders, he said, well, those people have been here for quite a few years, and they've turned, most of them have turned into very solid citizens. And so, yeah, people have started businesses, Rooster Brother, Borealis Press, Woodland Studios, and teachers in the Surrey School, and many, many other things. And basically, it's just like Audrey just said, we're here. We raised our kids here. We sent them to the Surrey School. And after you've been here a little while, when you come here from away, you didn't know you were from away, but you learn what that means, and you come to respect that distinction between the people who have lived here for generations during the hard times. But on the other hand, hey, I've been here 43 years myself. The Surrey I came to had two gas stations. One was at Willard Cain's. One was in front of Charlie and Cack McGraw's store. Right next to that was a little bitty post office with Sharon's father in it, a McGraw, which is like saying royalty in Surrey. And it was just the next year that they built the present post office. Willard Cain was a piece of work. He had a picture of his World War I unit, this long, on the wall. And you'd go in there and he'd talk to you. Once he gave me something, he gave me a Breese's peanut butter cup. And I stepped outside and opened it up, and it was rotten inside. And I don't think he meant to do that, but it was just sort of the fact that his inventory didn't rotate very much. He lived in that store. He'd stay in that store. He'd go home and have lunch and then come back to the store. One day I was in there, and he said, well, I've been in this store 40 years. Says, of course, I was in the store next door for 30 years. And you realize, that's one of the ways you realize what from away means. At that time, there was no Surrey Town Hall. You registered your car across Charlie and Cack McGraw's kitchen table. So it was a different Surrey in those days. Not radically different, you know, one thing changes or two things change per year, and after you go 40 years, things look kind of different. And that's been the case with it. But it was a different Surrey. What we did on the farm, like I say, Walter grew up on a farm himself in New York, on Long Island, or as they say, Long Island, in New York. And so he was a farm boy, basically, and he had all of these people who wanted to study with him. Now, what studying with him meant was basically spending time on that farm. He wasn't sitting down and telling us the secret of the universe or anything like that. He would push and needle and maneuver us in ways that...
Charlie,
yeah?
Did you know that Walter was not allowed to work on his farm in New York because he was a piano protege?
Yeah.
And he always wanted to drove him, so when he
That's
came
right.
here, that was he had to learn how to farm and use his hands!
That's right. Okay, so here's the Nowick household. They got 9 kids. And they had a piano teacher come in on every Saturday. And she would give, his father played the piano by ear, as I remember the story, And he was next youngest kid. And so she'd be giving 8 piano lessons ahead of him. And he'd be standing there, he's 4 years old. Hey, can I do it? Can I do it? Can I do it? And by the time he was 14, there was this opportunity. He must have been pretty good to go to the Juilliard. And he was a hell of a pianist. But you had to have been there. But he was a wonderful, wonderful pianist. He didn't want to go. And his mother took him outside and you get in that car. That's how she told the story. And that's the summer that he came up to Surrey. So he had real roots here, actually. By the time he sort of inherited the Morgan farm. Because it went from our house down to Margaret's, almost down to the bridge. There's a lot of area. And he gave most of it away, sold some of it for whatever, but he wasn't attached to a whole lot of things like that. What we did was, okay, here's how far back Bill and I go. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to call him Willie because that's what we call him on the farm. He's a Charles William. I'm a Charles MacNeil. We're both Charleses. So we have this in common. Did you know that?
Yeah.
First person I would see to speak to in the morning would be Bill Rayton in the milk house. We were milking, 13?
17.
17 at the beginning, yeah.
No, at the beginning, one or two, and that's when we would bring the milk to Henry's. We would carry it in a can to Henry's big milk basin, where they would pick it up to take it to the, wherever they took it.
Yeah, but this was after that, when they had the big tank in the milk house.
That's when we had 17.
That was 17.
Cows.
17 cows, yep. We even had a Holstein.
One Holstein.
Her name was Joanna. We had a Swiss. Her name was, what was her name?
Jersey.
First one was Jersey. What was her name?
Little Red.
Jersey.
She gave milk that was so rich that you could take a bucket of that cream and turn it upside down and nothing would come out of the bucket. No, serious. If it had sat there for a while. So, here's Bill. Hi, Bill. You know, and so we would get going on this thing, it was Bill Rayton and me, and we'd be and Sheldon Bisberg, whom you've only known Sheldon since you were how old?
4.
Oh, see, okay, yeah. Speaking of Fiddler on the Roof, right? Because Bill used to do the music, Sheldon would do the music, he'd do the drama, and Kenny Weinberg, who built the Zendo down there. Same era, same people, same Brooklyn.
Since we were 12.
Oh, well, 12. Well, you were practically, you actually were grown up by that time, I imagine. But anyhow, Bill would be charged with putting the milking machine on the cow. Sheldon would hold the cow's tail. Because that is a very important thing to do, because the tail is kind of poopy, and Bill was right there doing this thing, and so Sheldon was charged with holding the cow's tail so it didn't go and whack Bill in the face. And I would be taking care of the other end of the cow, putting haylage and grain and stuff like that. And this, yeah, they were coming and picking it up out of that tank, weren't they, still in that era?
They would come, the main truck would come and take it out of the tank. Sheldon would wash all the utensils.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. It's not the first dairy I've worked in. I didn't have to do all the washing there, but boy, you got to wash stuff. So that was that part of it. Then there was there were two sawmills. There was the little 9-foot Frick carriage, which had been there forever. And Just as I arrived, he bought a 20-foot lane carriage, this Danish guy and I built a sawmill there, and we had, and it, that was run by electricity, believe it or not. We had a generator, and so the whole point of this was to give people something to do so they could be there generate a little income to keep things going, and people who didn't have jobs off the farm would get 25 cents a week. I don't know what, not much, believe me.
$25 a week.
$25 a week. Yeah, that would, you were.
$25 a week, bring up four kids.
Yeah, that's because you were a married man. I wasn't a married man at the time. No. Yeah. And then.
Yeah. Question.
Yeah.
Do you think that he used that setting in order to be able to impart his teaching, have more opportunities to have, you know, this real setting be an opportunity for his teaching? Taking it back to the Zendo. And,
yes.
How did he get you guys into the Zendo, us guys into the Zendo?
Okay. So if you read books about Zen, which sometimes people do, you read an awful lot about hours and hours of sitting and great intensity and screaming and yelling sometimes and this and that. At least that's what we thought it all was about. This was turned it all on its head. I came here from a very formal practice in San Francisco with robes and shaven heads and the chanting and carrying on like that. Here, it was nothing like that. There were two training periods a year, about 2.5 months each. You'd
so
sit,
it was 3 months on, 3 months off.
Something like that, yeah.
That was 3 months on, 3 months off, and that's what he did in Japan. And then he kept doing the singing and the farm work.
Yeah.
It got a little...
But, frankly, it took me a couple of years to figure out what was going on that farm. Is not just all the sitting. All this business of doing meditation is very important. It allows you to come to know your mind a little bit and so on. And it does. It's very important. But there's another aspect to it. And the other aspect to it is a little hard to describe. But what I can tell you about it, well, I had a when I was in college, I took a class in statics and strength of materials. And it was from an old Jewish guy named Sammy Sloan. And he would come in wearing his yarmulke and whatnot, and he looked like Jehovah, boy. He was tough. And he'd stand up there at the board and say, "Okay, I am going to explain this to you. Of course, a student never listens. A student never learns. You won't get it. But I'm going to tell you." And then, and he would just say this. Now, Walter wouldn't exactly say that. But here was the effect that Sammy had on his students. And it was almost universal. He was very tough. And if you had homework, you had to get up there and do it on the board in front of everybody every class. And he didn't cut you any slack. When you're pushed that way, when you're pushed in a very personal way like that, you don't like that person, but you can come if that person is trying to teach you something you want to know. You can come to intensely respect, and I think probably everybody in this room has had an experience of working for someone or with somebody who is a real pain. And then you look back on it 5 years later and say, "Wow, I learned a lot from that person." So the principle of what was going on in the farm, to me, that's the analogy. And it could be anything. Now, I'm a carpenter. I've been a union carpenter. I know how to do stuff. I do. In ordinary sense, this was catnip. To to Walter. Because as carpenters know, things have to be plumb, they have to be level, they have to be square, you have to use good materials, you can't waste anything, and you want to be working with competent people, right? Right. And he could take all of that away from you simply by creating this difficulty and that difficulty and the other difficulty. Now, if you regard that as being a kind of teaching, then it's of use to you. If you just say, this guy's just being a jerk, well, then he's a jerk and you go away. But I don't know if this makes any sense at all. But if you came here to, and see, I came primed with this background and whatnot, to understand a little bit of this, that's what was happening there. People of Surrey said, what are those people doing there? They have to be crazy. They have to be having Wesson oil parties. I don't know what people were saying to each other. So we began having an open house. I don't know, how many people been to the open house? Okay, decent number. Did you come? Bill came. So every summer we would have an open house. And people would come down to the Zendo, as you are all, the Zendo is the name for the meditation hall and the whole little area down there. If you haven't been down, come down sometime on a Sunday in the afternoon. And just to kind of humanize the whole thing and make sure we were, you know, just to get, well, these are just people. And I think that's one of the ways we got on that basis.
Hold back. Walter told us all to hold back. Don't eat a damn thing till everybody else ate. And we'd be starving. We'd be starving and worked all day at the pool ready.
Let's go.
You remember, Charlie, hold back. You stood there. people come over and say, hi.
If you didn't learn something from that, then you were wasting your time.
Charles, thank you so much. It was lovely.
I hope it was coherent.
Yeah,
thank you.
So interesting. Thank you. Yeah. All right. So here we go. All right. Bill Maiden. Okay. I don't know. Would you like to introduce him?
I think I already have. Although I did tell Bill that one of the reasons I have never been in one of his productions in my daughter has, and there have been endless productions over the years, is because after working with him in the Milk House, I felt as if I'd already been in a Bill Ray great production.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay.
Well,
do you want the stage to be cleared so you can dance?
Yeah, take that chair off. Are you strong enough? What a woman. Look at this woman. She must be a Zen student. She got all that strength. Ta-da!
There we go.
Thank you. Can you hear me without the microphone? No? You want the microphone?
Ooh,
you would say that. You would say that. Well, then I'll have to sit. Okay. I worked for Walter and lived at the Zendo for 20 years, 1969 to 88. In 88, I left for the Leningrad, stayed there for 3 months, and came back and continued the New Surrey Theater other than here. But I want you to know, when we came to Surrey in 1969 in November. We were in a Volkswagen van. Me, Kenny Weinberg, my ex-wife Joan, my little baby daughter, Sheldon Bisberg, Merle Bisberg, Alan Cuff, and our dog Buddy. And Kenny was stuck in the back with our dog Buddy, and we didn't know it. He kept feeding the dog Clorets because his breath was so bad. And the dog kept going, bleh, bleh. What's going on? The breath was just too much. And we were coming to Surrey because we had read about Buddhism as a way, Zen Buddhism, to open your mind and find out about yourself. And we needed to. We were from Brooklyn, New York, you know. We were pretty weird, you know, the life we were living.
And I was doing theater in upstate New York with Sheldon, and we had traveled all over. And we were looking for a teacher. We heard there was a teacher here in Surrey, Maine. And we're coming down the Tuddy Pond Road, and everything is brown. Everything is drab. I said, oh, what a great place to suffer. What a great place to suffer. Oh, boy. And we're driving down the road. We're looking for, where's a little shack? We want to see a little shack where the Zen teacher will be sitting on top of a mountain quietly. And we finally found the farm. And we go in, and he says, get out! It seems he didn't want any students. He had Fred Ketchum and Deborah Moskowitz, and Paul Weiss was visiting, and his nephew, who we knew, Joan and I knew from New Hampshire, and we didn't know what to do. We came all this way. He says, get out, you know. But we remembered in the books we read, they would tell you to get out to prove that you wanted to stay. So we got out. And Paul White says, hey, I'm staying at that log cabin near the Ups and Downs. You know that log cabin? If you're going from Surrey to Blue Hill, there's a log cabin there. And, I'm staying there. I'm renting that. Come and stay there. So we did. And the next day, Walter said he'd see us. And we went there, nervous, scared, all of us. Oh, my cousin Paul. Paul Lentini, a piano player. He earned his living playing at the piano bar, like Joel, Billy Joel, you know. So, and we went in, and yes.
I'm not asking you to stop. I'm asking you to hold the microphone a little bit horizontal.
I love you for telling me that. You are so kind to me. This is, I mean, I needed you my whole life, Ma. She was my neighbor. She was my neighbor for years. My daughter, who happens to be here tonight, was in love with her son when they were growing up together. They never told each other that. But they, oh, it was just amazing. He was so good looking. And we go in there, and Walter's sitting there, and he says, okay, my teacher told me that if I'm going to teach, I'm going to have to teach, and you people came, I'll be your teacher. So Paul jumps up, goes to the piano, and starts to play the Beatles song, Here Comes the Sun. And we all start singing, la-da-da-da, here comes the sun. And Walter's sitting there like, he had never heard the song, and it's not classical music. You know? So he accepted us as students, and we all moved up. And as Charlie told you, he would give everyone an acre of land, but you couldn't sell that house that you built for any profit. When you left, you could sell it for whatever it cost you to another student or to anybody else, but you couldn't make profit on it. And Jan Willem van der Wettering, you know Jan Willem van der Wettering? He moved here from Holland to be a student, and he bought my house, and I ended up building a little cabin because I wanted to be more Zen. Like, but a little cabin, my wife and I were like this, and the children were on the legs, you know. It was frightening. But it was right next to Margaret eventually. And I had built a house in New Hampshire. I lived in the woods in the winter, and I did my theater in the summer to earn the money to do that. And while we're sitting there, Walter says, anybody here know how to build? Everybody pointed to me because I had built a house. But the whole house was crooked. I built the house. It was terrible. I didn't know how to build. I just built a cabin. And he said, okay, you'll build us a cow barn. Oh, okay. And we built the cow barn. Bobby Ray. Anybody here remember Bobby Ray from Ellsworth? He was you worked for Bobby?
Yeah.
He poured the cement for my foundation of my house, which became Jan Willem's. And we hired somebody from his crew to help us with the cow barn. And that person was the wrong person to hire. And we didn't put the tar on the outside of it. Oh, but all those stories, you don't want to hear those stories. I'm going to tell you about, ta-da, what did I tell you about? I'll tell you about how we met John McGraw.
Hey,
yeah.
When Bill Rayton, I was told, and I worked on that log cabin, was everybody that does their log cabin with their logs going horizontal,
I want mine going vertical. And he did. And there exists a photograph of his son, Joshin, looking out the window as we had put a cable all the way around that thing, so we squeezed it all together.
Well, the reason we built the house with logs going up and down was because I could cut every log, didn't have to buy it, could carry it out myself, and I had a table saw, and I took the sides off, three sides, and then I put a groove on two sides so Norman Rosicky could put a spline in it and then put tar on it. But Norman got lazy, and he said, "Oh, it's too much work here with the, in the winter. I'm not going to put tar on it." So he didn't put the splines in, and every winter after it shrunk, I had to wrap the house in plastic to stop the wind from coming in. Norman, I'll never forgive you, Norman! But that was a silly thing. Well, we had the mill that we built, that Charlie worked on and leveled with that Danish fella who was very tall, big blonde hair, and it was wonderful. What was his name, you remember? But it was really a wonderful mill. And it Walter and I, most of the days, would do it alone. He would run the zzz, zzz, and I would run and get, and I would get the PV on the floor, and I would roll around up to the ledge and get it onto the bed frame. Then I'd run to the other side, and he would take off the slab. I'd take the slab off, put it on the side, and try and chuck it. And it was wonderful. I felt I was learning something, I think. And it was just wonderful work to do. We had a forklift that had no brakes. So to slow it down and stop it, you had to try and go uphill or somehow downshift. It was very weird. But I think Marvin wanted me to talk about the theater. Charlie talked great about the Zendo and all this stuff. It was really wonderful. Kenny Weinberg, who came with us, who I grew up with, never built anything before he built the Zendo except movie sets. He worked on movies with De Niro and Barbara Streisand. He was very talented and very, he wasn't famous because he was a crew, but very successful. And Walter heard that, and he and Walter designed the Zendo. And then Walter gave him a young man to work with him who was brain damaged. His parents sent him up to be a student, hoping it would help him. And he and this boy, who was just a really nice boy, smiling all the time, but he didn't do anything. And they built it themselves, the two of them, until it was like 80% done. And then Walter had everybody come and help. And we did the floors, and we did the roof, and we did the, oh, it was just, it was a beautiful thing. And since then, Kenny has built a lot of houses. He just learned how to do that. He loved it. But when I first came here, I wanted to have my ego out. I didn't want to have my ego. I would go to Willard Cain's to make sure my ego was demolished. And he would help demolish my ego. He'd take his teeth out. Wah, 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 wah. My kids would scream, you know. And I took a job. I don't know. You know Henry Cain? You guys don't? Well, are you Surrey people? What's going on here? Henry Cain lived on Newbury Neck. He had a farm. You remember Henry? I worked for Henry. I yarded wood for Henry. He taught me how to yard wood. I walked to his house from Morgan's Bay, and then we would walk back with his horse, Molly, to where the radio tower is. And he owned land to the right, and we'd go down, and the first time he took me down, we were both on the horse, on the wagon. We got off the wagon, we turned it around, and we loaded the wood. He taught me how to use a hook. He and John taught me how to use a wood hook, which, well, using your hands when you're doing wood, well, wood hook is like you're a hero, you know, just really wonderful. And after it was loaded, it must be half a cord at least, maybe more. He said, "Okay, take her out." I said, "Okay, get on there. Are you coming on?" Said, "Nope." "Oh, okay, take her out." I go, "Okay." The horse hears that. Vroom! It knew if it got fast, it would get rid of the load. And it goes down the road, man. And I'm holding on. I'm standing up. And he's walking behind, you know. We get to the end of the road again to where we're going to unload the wood. I said, "Henry." He said, "It's okay. You'll do." And then I did it by myself. It was just wonderful. And he had an aunt, Mabel. Anybody know Mabel? Yeah. Well, Mabel, I'm with my 8-month-old daughter and my ex-wife, and we walk in to meet Henry to talk about the job, and we hear this woman, beautiful old elderly woman, this friggin' machine, okay, the friggin' clothes aren't gonna get friggin' dried, and you know, it's friggin' around all this time. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Friggin' is not a word you use in Brooklyn, New York if you don't want to get beaten up. I looked at my ex, she looked at me, and I, ooh, tough lady. Then we learned that's a word everybody uses, so it was okay. And he had a young man who worked for him who was a little slow, but always smiling. And he was a wonderful guy. He never wore insulated boots. In the winter, he wore rubber boots that weren't insulated. We thought he was a hero. Because we had 8 pairs of socks and 7 boots. I mean, that was it. And his brother, Walter, owned the creamery. So I thought to be a Zen student, I should not have any ego, which I have none now, you notice. Oh, I got rid of it all. I got rid of it. And so I did jobs that weren't in theater. I took a job working for Henry. I took a job with Walter Kane at the creamery. I drove truck. I took it out to Mount Desert Island delivering juice and milk and stuff. And one day I'm coming back from Mount Desert Island in the truck, and there's no brakes on the truck. I couldn't believe it. I stop, I call up. I had to find a place to call. There's no cell phones, you know. And Walter comes down and says, okay, I'll take it. Aren't you going to get it fixed? No, I'll drive it. You drive behind me in my rig. Okay. And he drove without brakes from Mount Desert Island back to the creamery right in Ellsworth. I couldn't believe it. He went up in awe in my life, that man, I'll tell you. Even when he moved from his house to the house next door in Surrey. Do you know that? He lived in Surrey at on a house near the line, and they were moving. They moved to the house right next door, which was interesting. Nobody finds it interesting? I thought it was very interesting.
Opposite Jane Lord.
What's that?
Opposite Jane Lord.
Can't hear.
Opposite Jane Lord.
Yes, right across from Jane Lord's. Right. And, oh, yeah, he's still there. He was a wonderful man. We had a lot of fun with Walter. Sheldon worked there, too, would come in singing. He would make the chocolate milk, and he loved sweets, so half of it wasn't made. Half of it he drank. But one day, and I also worked as a custodian in Ellsworth at the public schools, and I worked at the Knowlton School, which is gone now. Now they have a playground there. And one day I'm working there, and I would bring a radio and be singing the songs on the radio, and I'd see in the window all these kids looking in the window. I said, hey, come on in. So they came in, and they would move the chairs for me, and they would put them back, and I got out in half the time. The next, about a week we were doing that, and then I get called into the principal's office. We have a complaint, you know. I said, what? They think you're a child predator. I said, what? So you're getting all those children in. I said, yeah, they're working. They're learning how to work. So we got that cleared. And then Walter explained to me that you're a director, right? That's the explanation. I said, yes. So direct. That was it. And that's when I started to direct in Ellsworth. But I had to go to the principal of the Knowlton School because I felt obligated. It was very nice. I had to tell him why I was leaving, and I was... I went to him in my paint overalls, all filthy and stuff from having just finished cleaning all the rooms. And I said, I have to tell you, Ken, that I have to leave because I just can't do this thing. So what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm a professional theater director from New York, and I decided to direct again. He says, oh, wait. Takes out his wallet. This is my son. He's right in school. He's a great actor. If you can do any work here. And, oh, great. All right. Yeah. Oh, my God. So then we did a play with Sheldon and I. We did. I went to the Ellsworth Players. Their director had just retired. And I offered my services to do a musical. But they had never done a musical. They'd only done straight plays. The only musicals were done by George Demas at Mount Desert Island High School, and he was wonderful, a real genius, the young man. And so they're sitting there, said, well, what'll it cost? So I told him what the rights are, and I said, and I want $500. What? Sorry, I got going to take 3 months. All right, we'll give you 500. This is Margaret Oba. I don't know if you know Margaret Oba. I love this woman. We've known each other all these years. This is in 1972. And I said, good, now we need to hire a musical director. And I have Sheldon Bisberg. I've worked with for years. And she says, you're getting $500? You want a musical director? Take it out of your money. That's the first play we did. Sheldon and I split the $500. But we did Fiddler on the Roof at the City Hall. And Sam Taylor, who wrote Sabrina and the Hitchcock movies, wonderful, talented man, the Ellsworth American, because they had never had a musical, asked him to review it. He wrote the greatest review you can imagine. I mean, it was superlative. And Herb Mitchell, who had started with me, he was a stockbroker in Bangor, and he had never acted before. Yeah, but we couldn't get Atevia, which is the lead in the show, a very important role. And about 150 people came to audition. It was amazing, but none of them, you know, you just couldn't. So I said, Herb, you have to audition. He says, oh, I'm not acting. He said, the last time I acted, I only acted once, and I came out on the stage, tripped, and everybody laughed, and it was a drama. I said, it's okay, so just try out. So he sang for Sheldon, and he read for me, and Sheldon and I talked about it, and he came out and said, okay, Herb, you can't sing, and you can't act, but you got the part. And he was 3 months. We worked every day. I would meet him at his house. He would walk up and down the Ellsworth Road, and one day he got it, you know, and he was absolutely wonderful. The cast was fantastic. It was weird because at the end of the play, the cast, I had them walk through the audience crying because they were all being kicked out of their homes, and they were crying, really crying. And Herb's daughter, Kelly, her grandmother was sitting on the aisle, and as Kelly walks by, her grandmother goes, oh, you're wonderful. She wouldn't break the character. This was just wonderful. So Sam Taylor comes back with another man to see the show on the second weekend, because it was so good, and from New York. And they meet with Herb afterward, and they tell Herb that they would like him to come to New York City to audition for this director who just saw him play, because he thinks there's something that they just see something in him. And Herb says, when is that? And they said, in 2 weeks. And Herb says, oh, I can't do that. That's the cast party. Years later, Herb was kicking himself, hitting himself, because he became a professional actor, did commercials, was in movies, and I couldn't believe he didn't go, you know. But after that, I talked with Walter about the use of the barn. And he said, I could use the barn. And we advertised, and we called up friends we knew in California, New York, and we got 28 actors to come to live with us, many from Maine, many from the area. I also had done Charlie Brown at the Ellsworth High School, and Music Man with the Ellsworth Players, and people that had been in that play wanted to study with us. And we advertised that we were doing Fiddler on the Roof in the barn. Well, we got a call about a week after we advertised it from Cleveland. They wanted 4 tickets. And we said, boy, this is it, you know. And we got a check from them, and I put it in a box. I'm going to save it for when we get all the stuff come in. When we finally tried to cash it, it bounced. So I'm glad I didn't try and cash it right away. But what happened was the barn had a corner of it that was covered with sheep dip because a student, what was his name? Yes, Kantner had sheep in the barn. Walter let him use the barn for sheep. And it was all full of sheep poop. So one of the most important parts of the acting school was to shovel out the sheep poop. They understood that. That was their job. Then there was somebody who lived on the Ellsworth Road who had written the radio show Gangbusters.
Bill Long.
Who?
Phillips H. Long.
Yes, yes. And he lived right across from Rio. Yes. Because Rio's mom was our first stage manager in Fiddler on the Roof. So, yes, yes, she made a cake. Boy, she would have cake for me every time she showed. Oh, I loved it. It was wonderful. He had a nurse, because he had to take oxygen, from England, who, when we talked, because we met a few times, she said that she had done makeup and costumes in England. So I said, oh, would you do the makeup for us, for Fiddler on the Roof? She said, sure. And I had just done Kismet at Peaks Auditorium, and Ralph Robinson, who had just retired from dancing in Europe with his wife Jean-Marie Aubert, was doing the choreography there. We became friends, and he said he would do the choreography and dance the Russian parts in the barn. And who else did we have? Well, that's what I can remember right now. Dwight Lamfer. Dwight Lamfer from MDI High School. He now runs a big electric company in Northeast Harbor. One Lamfer Associates. He was a genius. And we would rehearse in my driveway in the gravel. We had no place to rehearse. So Ralph would come and they would do the dancing right in the driveway. And when we went to do the makeup for the show, our green room, which is a place where you put on makeup and costumes in theater, was the cow barn. And it coincided with when the cows and Charlie came in. But he wasn't there at the time. This is 1972. And they would be putting on their makeup with the cows behind them munching on hay. But I mean, I'm behind them by a foot or two, because the tables were against the wall. And there was the... Walter would sneak in every once in a while and play the piano as Sheldon was playing it. It drove Sheldon crazy. It was a smash success. We had 135 seats we could get in there, but opening night, there were another 135 people standing on the road on that corner by Morgan's Bay Road. So I started bringing them in. Sam Taylor had tickets. He didn't show up by curtain time, so I sold his seats. And people were coming. Meanwhile, suddenly I see Sam running down the road with his wife and two guests, and I had to put them on the floor, and everybody's sitting on the floor, and Ralph Robinson says, I can't dance. I'm going to be jumping on people's heads. I said, oh, jump. They'll love it. And we had the reverend from... the Episcopal Church in Ellsworth was the innkeeper, and when he had to go and tie the rope to separate the men and the women for the wedding, there was no place to put it, so he'd give it to someone in the audience, hey, would you hold this, please, somebody. And it was just a wonderful time, a wonderful time. And I don't know how much more you want to tell them, Margaret.
Wonderful, Bill, and there's so much more I think that we can come up with.
Yes. Some other time we could...
And people are responding and people are remembering their own things as you're talking. So it's been really incredible.
Well, it's all... You invited us all and you talked us into it. I don't know how she did it.
I got to say something, you know. And I shouldn't say this, except that I know Rayton has no ego, so... When I first came here, I had to wait for about 2.5 months because I arrived at the beginning of a training period and Walter said, no new people, I can't go away. So I just stayed with somebody locally, I went to a play, a musical, at GSA. And I'm going to this musical, and it's Oklahoma or something like that. And who was directing it? This is Rayton and Bisberg. You go to the high school play, you know how it is. There's two or three kids that are pretty good, and everybody else, hey, there are kids, you know, we gotta go. When you went to one of these things, and I went to several of them before I knew this community, there would be 8 or 10 guys that were really good. I mean, it was just like, wow, I don't even have to put on those rose-colored glasses. You have to do it, yeah. And somehow those guys got things out of these kids. I'm just testifying to that from my own vision of it, I've never seen on a high school stage.
Oh, thank you, Charlie. Thank you very much. It's true. Thank you.
Gwen.
And there will be more, I'm sure. Okay, so now we have Marge Longwood, who is going to...
Thank you, dear. I'm not going to. I donated that stool. No way. I'm using it.
Two people helping you up?
No.
Okay, you're going to stand? Would you like the chair down?
No.
You can just go stand. Okay, I'm not going to say what you're going to do.
No, because I don't know what I'm going to do until I do it.
Do it. Okay.
And Bill was giving me more lead-ins every time he spoke another paragraph. And a couple of things I wanted to say. Some of you, although I see a lot of new faces, were at the Historical Society meeting back in, I think it was July of 2006. I had just retired as a Presbyterian minister out in Michigan and could have gone any place in the world to live. And I said, why would I want to go any place but the coast of Maine? Because I'd been brought up in East Blue Hill. And so I came back, and the Historical Society was going to do a sharing time like this. And my father, who was John McGraw, who was alluded to there a couple of times, had always was a storyteller and telling about people in Surrey and East Blue Hill. John was born 103 years ago in the farm just up the road. And I live just up the road, a mile as the crow flies, from where he was born those years ago. And I didn't know that when I rented a house out on Patton Pond Road. And so there's more than one way in which we kind of the circle of life, so to speak. Well, I was going to read some of John's work. While Mother was suffering from advancing problems of age, he would keep her at the apartments in Blue Hill Terrace Apartments, and he would write stories. And he wrote about 14 books, those self-publishing books about life in East Blue Hill. One of the problems was he'd write about one story, and then he'd pick it up, you know, a few months later and add some more to it. And my cousin, Dr. Robert Fortine, who practiced in Anchorage, Alaska, took his sheets of stories from he began with and edited them enough so a person could read them, because John didn't use capital letters or punctuation. He said he didn't talk that way and he didn't need to put them in his story, but Cousin Robert did. And so someday there's still those other 14 books. I'll never get through them. I thought I'd rewrite them in my retirement. I don't think I will. But anyway, I'll share some more stories another time. But I digress. So in that July meeting of the Historical Society, I was going to share some stories. And one of the funniest ones, I thought, to start off with, was a story of when Johnny and Kathy and Sharon's father, Danny, I think it was, and then their younger brother, Arnold, used to go sliding in the wintertime. And they went to, it was called Liberty Hill at that time. That's the road to Blue Hill. And they'd get their sleds going mighty fast and come down that hill. Well, that time they went, they did one time. Somebody else around here is going to have to tell me the name of the man who said he could walk in the middle of the road because it was his constitutional right. Does anybody remember that?
Horace Young.
Horace Young, okay. Well, they're sliding down the hill, and there's Horace Young walking in the middle of the road, which was his constitutional right to do it, and very bow-legged. And so John went to one side, Danny went to the other, and I don't know where Arnold went. And they each slid over his foot, his respective foot. And they got to the bottom of the hill, and they decided they'd better go back and see if they'd heard him. And my father wrote all we caught with a little help for them. And I couldn't imagine that was a true story, except on the July 2006 newsletter of the Historical Society, by God, that was a black and white photograph of that man walking in the middle of the road with one leg that way and one leg that way. So I knew it was the truth, but that's not all of John's stories were the truth. Well, I came home, let's see. I went to University of Maine and George Washington University and on and on. And I'd come home about every year. And I came home at some time in the mid-70s, and I was such a young woman of the world, you know, and wanted to be seen as I don't know what. But I was studying to be a Foreign Service agent or something, I don't know. And I came home, and my father was so proud that he was teaching the boys from Brooklyn over there in the Walter Nowicks barn how to do things like thread the baler so the bales of hay would come out and be all tied up, and how to fix his tractors, and just the things that John knew, because that's what he did. You know, he had one time 100 Holsteins they milked morning and night, and then the rest of the day he would go into the woods and cut wood for the pulp mill in Bucksport. Well, one of the best stories I heard is he took some of these fresh young boys from Brooklyn, New York, into the woods, but they couldn't do much of the work. It would take three of them on one tree that John could handle by himself.
John could take a 4-foot piece of pulp wood that was this round, and we had to get it to the top of the truck because we had got all the piled up there. He says, put it up there. And he went like this. He took it from the bottom, standing up, and here's this 4 foot. He goes, whop! And he throws it right onto the top.
So what name did you call him? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
The Bull of the Woods.
Bull of the Woods, right.
Kenny Weinberg.
Yep.
And I worked for Kenny Weinberg a few summers ago when he had the antique shop. And I just have to laugh at how things go around, come around. And if you're open to it, even people from away can come a part of this story you tell. Because I grew up in the 50s around here, and there was a clear delineation between people from away. And me and my girl cousins, one by one, we worked for the rich people, you know. And that was kind of funny because we were so cussed independent, you know. We didn't dust every table and do this or that. Didn't really care what fork you ate your salad with and stuff like that. So anyway, sometime I'll tell you about John's experiences down in the old country school. One day, he was, oh, Lord, he was hard to live with all his life, but I pity the poor teacher. She was spat in his hand with a ruler, and she was crying, and John was laughing. I don't know what he did, but he remembered all those stories, and they may not be true, but we don't let that interfere with a good story. So, anyway, it's just fun to be here, because we didn't plan this sharing of stories, you know, but you know, everybody has a pretty good story. And see, Sandy and Florence McGraw, I don't know when they were married, but they had most of their 10 children here in Surrey. And most of them went, I think, to the old Surrey school. Yeah, I think most of them. And most of the children and the grandchildren stayed in this area. And I grew up at a time when one night on weekend, the brothers in the family would get together and play poker, and the women would sit in the living room and talk. And we were at Kathy and Sharon's house they grew up in, which is no longer, and just run through the big old house. And I remember that upstairs kitchen always smelled like graham crackers. And they're using that wood in the rebuilding of the something there.
Country school.
Yeah, in the old country school. So I hope it still smells like graham crackers. So anyway, that's all I'm going to tell you now. If you want to hear about his life at school and some of the other nefarious things he liked to brag about, why, we'll have to catch up another time. Thank you to Margaret and all those who put this together. Oh, I know one thing I wanted to be sure to say, because I was going to apologize to any of the people my father argued religion with who came up to me. I was absolutely mortified when he boasted about arguing with the boys from Brooklyn about their religion. Oh, Lord.
Thank you, Marge. It's the last of our storytellers planned for this evening, but another big thank you to all of the wonderful storytellers this evening. And again, thank you to everybody for making this such a success. And also, I see Rita out there doing dishes, and Sharon, and everybody else who helped with the cleanup while the rest of us were enjoying the stories. A big thank you for that. And everyone, feel free to stick around and visit some more. And do come back to the gatherings. We have game night tomorrow night and something happening almost every day. So we hope you'll come back often. Thank you.